She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And trust me when I say we are going to give you some wonderful things to think about today. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. And of course, I always give a big thanks to the sponsor of this particular show and all of our shows. For this one, it's the Fairfax Companies. They are true leaders in the business of sustainability, and I so mean that, and I say it with passion every single time. They are dedicated to improving the environment through creative and innovative business practices and are leaders in the construction waste industry, demonstrating that it's possible to implement sustainable businesses practices profitably always. We appreciate their support of our mission and our vision and the great work they do for the community and for the planet. To find out more about them, please visit them at thefairfaxcompanies.com. So I'm going to take a deep breath because I'm rushing to get to the show and really say from my heart that there aren't a lot of words to describe how excited and eager I am to do this show for lots of personal reasons. And the crux of it is because the guests today have successfully learned how to build consensus in a very polarized country right now. Their leadership is so impressive. So let it be known that we're going to be talking about conservation, leadership, staying the course. And I'm excited because of the guests, because of their commitment to finding common ground and building bridges, and because I care deeply about wildlife. And anybody who knows me knows that truer words were never spoken. So get ready. Joining us for this next hour are Dave Chadwick, Executive Director, and Bill Geer, President of the Board from the Montana Wildlife Federation. And if you're listening, sitting down, or if you're by your computer, or if you have an opportunity, you should go to montanawildlife.org as we go throughout the show so you can see the beauty of what they're doing and the difference they're making. This federation is Montana's oldest, largest, and most effective conservation organization. And remember, we're talking about Big Sky, we're talking about a lot of public lands, so to hold that place is a big, big deal. Since 1936, they have led efforts to protect Montana's abundant fish and wildlife, their natural lands and waters, and public access for hunting, fishing, and other outdoor recreation. Their victories have been many. Their ability to build consensus in challenging situations is inspirational. And their passion for making a difference for the state of Montana and this great country of ours are just some of the reasons why I'm so glad to have you both here. So Dave and Bill, we made it work. A warm welcome to both of you.
Well, thank you. This is Bill.
This is Bill. And Dave, I know you're out in the wild somewhere and you had some wind, but thanks for making it work. It's our mantra here. We'll make it work. And
thank you so much for having us on.
I know. You can tell that I'm really excited and very passionate. And so anyway, I know that I think it would be what I really wanted to start with is, Dave, if you start by sharing us a bit more about the Montana Wildlife Federation. It has three main areas of focus, and just go into a little bit of detail about the magnitude and scope of your mission.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be glad to do that, and thanks again for having us on.
I'm so excited. It's my pleasure, literally.
and I guess I'll just give a little bit of general background on the Federation. And like you said, we were founded in 1936. We're an 81-year-old organization. And we were really founded when Montana, like much of the country, was really at a low spot in terms of our natural resources. And, you know, many of our fish and wildlife were depleted. Our forests and waters were degraded, and it was really the birth of the modern conservation movement. And the Montana Wildlife Federation was founded when a handful of people got together and said that we need to change things and do things differently. And those original founders included hunters and anglers. It included farmers and ranchers, wildlife watchers, people from across the spectrum who really cared about our fish and wildlife. And over the years, we've had a really impressive legacy of success. You know, our work, we cover a lot of different issues. You know, our agenda conservation-wise is almost as big as Big Sky Country. We work to protect scientifically managed abundant fish and wildlife, and that includes protecting big game like deer and elk. It also includes endangered species and species of concern. We also work to protect habitat on private lands and on public lands. Of course, Montana, like many western states, has a great deal of public land. We have about 30 million acres of federally managed public land. And we also have a lot of private land, farms and ranches, that also provide wildlife habitat. So a big part of what we do as an organization is work to protect the resource values on those public and private lands. We also work to protect water quality in our rivers and streams. And then we work on big issues that people might not conventionally think of as fish and wildlife issues, but ones that impact habitat. And right now we're putting a lot of energy, which Bill will talk more about, into tackling the impact that climate change has on fish and wildlife habitat. And then the third big area we work is in protecting access to the outdoors for hunting and fishing and other recreational needs. And that's always been a core value of our organization, because we think it's really important that people have an opportunity to connect with and enjoy the fish and wildlife resource. So those are the areas we work in. You know, we have several thousand members. We have members in Montana and members across the country who, you know, people who love to visit Montana and care about our fish and wildlife. Our members cover every end of the political spectrum and people from all walks of life. And, you know, we've really had good fortune over the years in being able to bring people together and have, you know, thoughtful discussions about our conservation agenda. And then the final piece I would just add is, so we are the Montana Wildlife Federation. We are affiliated with state wildlife federations in nearly every other state. And we work really closely with the Wyoming Wildlife Federation, the Idaho Wildlife Federation, and then we also nationally, all of our groups collectively make up the National Wildlife Federation, which is really one of the oldest and biggest conservation groups at the national level. So that's kind of a quick overview of our organization and what we do. And I guess I'd be glad to answer questions and talk about specific issues.
And I have a lot of questions, you can be sure, because it's like I talked to Bill a little bit beforehand as well. And when I read things, like, let's just hone in on the area of public access for a minute, because I've been doing this for 10 years. So when I get a surprise like this in doing my research, I mean, I think most people know that Montana really is a mecca for people who love the outdoors. I have only had the pleasure of visiting it once, and of course, it's a tourist thing. I'm going to say it was Glacier. You know, it's like, who wouldn't love the Glacier? But it's one of the main reasons is because of public access to so many amazing places. And yes, you have a lot of tourists, but one of the things that popped out of my research is people from Montana love public lands. I mean, the numbers are staggering. I read an article on your website that said 96% of your population takes advantage of those public lands, and frequently. I think I read that it's like at least 20 times a year. So,
yeah,
you know, that has to be a big area. And I think, you know, I live in the Grand Canyon state, and there's lots of people who've never even been to the Grand Canyon. So I think in Montana, you have a lot of active outdoors people. So what are some of the challenges, if you don't mind? Let's going into a little bit of, are those public access and public lands facing challenges in Montana right now?
Yeah, they are. And like you said, Montanans do, enjoy public lands in a really direct way, even more so than people in other parts of the West. And in fact, the conservation in the West Pole that's done by Colorado College every year found that not only do Montanans recreate on public lands at a higher rate than anybody else in the West, but also the number of Montanans who visit public lands more than 20 times a year is almost twice as high as any other state. And it's really a direct personal experience. It's really why people live in Montana. The other thing that's really important is participation in hunting and fishing. More than 50% of Montanans identify themselves as hunters and anglers, which is the highest rate of participation in the country. And then also related to that, Montanans have a very high rate of participation in wildlife watching. And again, there, Montanans, you know, they like to shoot deer and elk with guns during hunting season, and they like to shoot them with a camera the rest of the year. And there's a real.
I love the way you put that.
And it's part of, there's a real just direct connection to the outdoors that Montanans have. And in terms of some of the challenges facing our public lands, I'd say we have a couple. You know, Montana has abundant public lands. We also, a study found a few years ago that Montana actually also has the largest acreage of public lands that are inaccessible. And they call them, quote, landlocked lands, where there are areas of public land that for one reason or another, they're either surrounded by private lands or they have no, for one reason or another, they have no access. And so one thing that we put a lot of energy into is making sure that people can get to public land.
Got it.
And we can actually talk about some specific places where we have worked to protect and expand public access. We've also put a lot of energy into addressing the problem of people who, for whatever reason, will illegally block a public road or an access point to a stream or river. And that's just something we always have to be vigilant about. And it's something that really unites and brings Montanans together. And like I said, not only do we enjoy the outdoors and enjoy public lands at a higher rate than anybody else, but it's also really kind of a core value for Montanans because, you know, because we have such abundant public access to land and water, you know, this is a place where the size of your checkbook doesn't determine whether you can enjoy the outdoors. You know, you right. don't have to spend a lot of money. You can walk out your back door. You can drive to the end of a dirt road and enjoy national forests and other public lands. So, one area is that issue of access. Another big challenge that we've faced in recent years is there's been an effort to take our national public lands and either sell them off for private development or turn them over to state or local governments, which aren't really prepared to manage them. And so, and we've had to put a lot of energy into making sure that those national public lands stay open to the public. And that's something that we've had great success over the last couple of years because we have such strong public support. But there really is a handful of politicians who are really pushing this agenda of selling off public lands and closing off public access. And then probably the next big area that we put a lot of energy into is how our lands are managed and making sure that roadless areas on national forests are protected to provide security habitat for big game, making sure that those areas are protected from oil and gas development or mining or other activities that impact wildlife habitat, and also the public's ability to enjoy those lands. So we spend a lot of time participating in management discussions with the U.S. Forest Service and other land management agencies.
And, you know, it just comes to mind that because of it, I mean, that is a very big, big, wonderful, surprising statistic, about 96% of your population being engaged. It certainly, I'm sure, makes for some passionate public meetings and people really being engaged because they're aware of what the loss could be. Is that a fair assessment? I mean, they know, yeah. I'm using this and I love it and I want to keep it for myself and my children and my grandchildren. Because, I mean, of all states, Montana stands out as, you know, a big wow.
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example of that passion, if I may.
Jump in.
Java, several years ago, playing on that, I conducted a project called the Montana Sportsman Value Mapping Project. And the whole idea was to go to local rod and gun clubs where the public hunters and anglers belong to clubs in their local areas, a lot of them in Montana. I went to 43 of them in 32 communities around the state. We have 93.4 million acres in the state of Montana, I went to these folks and said, look, if these lands are under threat, we've got to work together to do something. And I, this is what I asked them to do. I said, I want you to tell me what you call your bread and butter hunting and fishing areas, areas you would sort of figuratively stand on with your fly rod and say, don't you touch the stream or I'll hit you with my fishing rod, you know, that they would go to the mat for. It's kind of like asking, where you give me your secret fishing hole and your favorite hunting area. You know, and, you know, people, hunters and anglers don't like kiss and tell fishermen and hunters and anglers. They don't like to share those secrets. But when they thought about the threats we were facing, they crossed their fingers, trusted me, and said, okay, we'll do that. And that, we, in about a three-year period, I went to all these clubs and mapped 76 million acres, which is more than all the public lands, federal public lands of Montana. That includes some state lands and private lands. They gave me the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, on 76 million acres around the state. And the reason they did it, I said, my gosh, we have to show our decision makers, our local politicians, our state politicians, our congressional delegates, the value we place on these lands, the ones that we are not going to give up. We are going to, you know, sort of fight to the death, so to speak, to protect. And they've done it. And we've used that to protect some lands, to acquire some protections, to acquire some additional lands, to open up some of the access that Dave was talking about to landlocked lands. This information, you might say it's a tool of political persuasion that shows the decision makers just how seriously Montana takes this and what they're willing to do to protect it. So they trusted us with that information. I promised I wouldn't put it in Field and Stream and Outdoor Life, and I didn't. So we have a database of what it means, yeah. So we can go to a piece of Montana. You pick a spot on a map. Biologically, our Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Agency and our fish and wildlife biologists like myself can tell you which species of fish and wildlife use that for what part of their life history, whether it's spawning or migration or whatever. But we can also tell you what people use it for hunting and fishing, for what species and when. And so that way we can demonstrate the value. And I've never been anywhere else where any hunter and angler is ever willing to trust someone and do that. But well, we did it.
That's because you said you wouldn't put it in any of those magazines because you would have been run out of state very quickly.
Well, you know what was interesting? I had a meeting about it. And then in that meeting was the editor of the Field and Stream magazine. And I showed him the project, and I said, this is all you're going to see about it. And he said, I'm not going to say a word.
That's right.
And he kept his word.
Yeah, and I get it about those secret spots where you don't want to tell people. Dave, were you going to chime in on that?
Well, yeah, and I think related to that is not only do people have this real tangible connection to the ground and can really talk about why these lands are important, but it also, we also gives us a powerful ability to motivate people and turn them out. And, you know, our legislature meets every other year. The last couple of legislative sessions, we've held public rallies in our state capitol. You know, we've turned out hundreds and even more than 1,000 people to fill the rotunda of our capitol to talk about and to yell loud about how important public lands are. And
it's so affirming. It makes me very excited.
Well, it's great. And, you know, and I also have to say the people we turned out really did come from all walks of life. It included hunters and anglers. It also included backpackers and backcountry skiers, mountain bikers, you know, everybody who really enjoys the outdoors. And that sends a powerful message. You know, that's what really has given us the ability in our state legislature to stop these efforts to take over federal lands and sell them off, and also to increase funding for public land protection and public land access. And it's just that real sort of grassroots power.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I just to give our listeners, we're about 1 minute to break, which is hard for me to believe. We have a 30-second break. But when we come back, I'd love to segue to talking about, in the next segment, some of the important work that Bill is doing in the Northwest that's really important and related to climate change, and then kind of bring it all together in our last segment with questions about, you know, the challenges and working with other organizations. And obviously, you both are good in your leadership roles about building consensus. And to me, when I said to you I was excited, yes, I love wildlife. You don't even want to hear from my kids how many hours I have spent looking for elk in the car and hiking and looking for, you know, the Mexican gray wolf and bears. And I'm a wildlife nut. So it really was near and dear to my heart. But in these challenging times where people are tearing each other apart, It was great to read about what you're doing to build, find common ground and build on that. We'll be right back, everybody. You do not want to move because we've got some great information in the next two segments. Stay here with me.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy, darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks for joining us. And joining us for this hour are Dave Chadwick, Executive Director, and Bill Geer, President of the Board from the Montana Wildlife Federation. And I'd just like to share a little bit more about our guests, who have obviously been making their mark in the wildlife arena for many years. Dave has 20 years of experience in the public and nonprofit sectors, largely focused on conservation issues. His background includes several years on Capitol Hill, both on the staff of a U.S. senator and as a lobbyist for the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. Good to have consensus-building skills in that job. Dave also has extensive training and experience in the collaboration and consensus-building, as I said, thus many of the epic victories we are learning about. Bill is a retired fish and wildlife biologist and former director of the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. He was the coordinator for the North American Waterfowl Management Plan for the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, vice president for field operations and conservation programs for the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and director of Western Lands for the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. He also serves on the boards of directors for the Montana Wildlife Federation, affiliate Hellgate Hunters and Anglers, which I'd love to know about that. And so retired is just somewhat of a stretch when we are describing you, Bill. I don't think you're retired at all. You just found another line of work that doesn't compensate you. So let's talk about this. And I just want to encourage both of you. It's, you know, I don't have a script that I have to follow. I love the conversation. And if either of you want to jump in, please do that as you did, Bill, because it's great to have the conversation. So, Bill, you are one busy guy. You're president of the board of the Federation. You're putting in a hardwood floor for your wife, which is a job in and of itself. For four decades, you've been working on wildlife conservation. You had the big chance for the big R, kick back, go fishing, see your grandkids, but that was not in your plans. So talk about what is your life's work right now as it relates to hunters and anglers and climate change.
Now, the two things I focus most heavily on in retirement, one we just discussed on maintaining and keeping federal public lands in public hands for the benefit of every American, whether they hunt or fish or recreate in some other fashion. And the other one is dealing with the phenomenon of climate change, or what we used to call global warming, and I've gone back to that because that's exactly what's happening. Climate change represents the greatest existential threat that we have to fish and wildlife, and probably to us, if the truth be known. And what we do now will determine whether or not we have many opportunities to hunt and fish in the future, regardless of who owns the land. It's the quality of the habitat and the ability to animals to survive there depends on many factors, and climate is one of the big ones. Is it too hot, too cold? Is there enough water? What kind of forage is out there, and will it still be there under changing climate conditions? And so I kind of dedicate myself, well, a lot to that. And before I retired, I built some state-specific videos just for Montana, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, and New Mexico. And each one of those, I did a state-specific assessment of how the climate change in that state is affecting fish and wildlife, and as a result, the opportunity for good hunting and fishing. But I also talked about examples of projects that people who take this seriously, called adaptation projects, are conducting to find ways to help fish and wildlife survive in the changing environment. Before I retired, I went around and on my paycheck, you know, I got grants and I built these videos and went to clubs and to better inform them on what they see in the field and what that means in terms of climate. And now I do it, for free on my own in retirement. It's still just as important, and that's what I choose to do.
And, you know, it was interesting to me because as Dave said, there are lots of mountain bikers, there are lots of hikers, backpackers, skiers, and hunters and fishermen. So why did you choose to focus on the hunter-angler population for your climate change presentations? Why did you think that was the area you needed to hone in on?
Well, that's where my professional expertise is. I've been a biologist before I retired, for 40 years.
Got
and
it.
I focused heavily on fisheries in Utah, the second most arid state, Nevada being the most, where water is in short supply in the best of years. And I kept wondering, why is water flow going down and down and down and down? And I'm trying to keep water in streams to keep fish alive. And I started thinking about what's causing this? This is a really long drought. Is it ever going to end? And I thought, it's bigger than a periodic drought. And if we don't do something about it, it's not going to end. And that was probably 30 years ago. And I didn't even call it climate change. And I said, holy cow, what's going on? Why are the flows going down so much in the streams that I'm working on? And in hunters and anglers, you know, there's about 70 million of them in the U.S., so there's certainly a very important political constituency. And if they take interest in something and say, we're going to stand up and speak for the resource, that's a pretty significant number of people that can go to our elected delegates and say, this is our view and this is what we want you to do. You represent us. They're not small. It's a large constituency, and it's important politically. And it happens to be where my expertise is. They are not the only ones that use a resource, but one thing hunters and anglers have, probably more than a lot of other people users, they're out there in tough times of year, and they're observing conditions because they're trying to catch fish and hunt wildlife. And they see things, and they see a lot, and they observe the details. Guys, the flows are low in August in my favorite trout stream, where I used to be wade chest deep, now it's ankle deep. Or the elk are staying very high in the mountains because there's not as much snow up there anymore, and we can't get up there in the hunting season. It's too high. And they see these conditions and wonder what's causing it. Or all the orange trees or the red trees from mountain pine beetle kill. How come that's happening? Why is it so much worse than it used to be? What's behind it, and how is it affecting my hunting and fishing? And they understand that, and so that's a natural constituency. I said, I am going to focus my attention on folks that are out there a lot that have a genuine, heartfelt passion for what they do, hunting and fishing. I saw a license plate that said, hunting and fishing isn't simply a matter of life or death. It's much more important than that. That's how they feel about it.
Yes, they do.
So they take that. So when they see these and they get the explanation, they galvanize. Like Dave said, we have rallies in our state capital of over 1,000 people saying, we want you to step up. This is important to us, and we're going to speak loud and long on this, and that's what we do. There are other losers as well, but I've been a hunter and angler my whole life, and I've been a professional fish and wildlife biologist. I was a fish and game agency director. You know, I've been a nonprofit as well, all on fish and wildlife. That's my area of expertise. Others can go along and probably do the same thing for mountain bikers and backpackers that take their I won't say peculiar, their particular interest at heart better than I can. But I know hunters and anglers, so that's where I focus my attention.
So let's get like down to it, down in the weeds, as I call it, or down in the stream. They are typically, this is just, you know, the facts. This group is typically Republican. They're typically conservative. You have earned their respect. You have credibility. Tell us about your approach. I think there are lots of decent people like me in the world, and people that care and want all this vitriol and nastiness that the press loves to pump up to go away. Talk about your specific approach, including why videos? Why do you use videos? Why not a PowerPoint? Why not have a discussion? It was very strategic in your choice to do that. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because you're getting to them because you respect them, because you know who they are, but it's also the medium, which I found fascinating. So can you talk about that for a little bit?
Well, for one thing, how do I get in? You know, people may claim, you know, hunters and anglers may complain about the state fish and game department, but, you know, when it gets right down to it, they love their local biologists and game wardens, and, you know, they're the folks that provide the hunting and fishing for them. And I get credit. I'm a fish and wildlife biologist for a long time, a former fish and game director, and I, you know, and I'm a senior citizen now. I'll be 70 in a couple of months, so I'm the right age group. And they look at me and say, you're one of us. You know, hey, you have our interest. Out. You're one of us. And so that gives me the entry credibility.
Yeah, but you're talking about climate change. So how does that...
That's right.
Yeah, so tell us about how that magic pill works.
Well, they say, gosh, if you're a fish and wildlife biologist, you're used to managing fish and wildlife in a practical manner, you've done it for all your adult life, and you take this seriously, there must be something to it. They have a tendency to listen. They at least listen to me and say, what can you tell us about this and we need to know? And what I did, when I built these videos, most people, when you go to a state, they want to know what's in their backyard, so to speak, like my hunting and my fishing and my local streams where I hunt elk and deer and so on. The next state, that's nice. I go there once in a while, but this is my state. Tell me about this. So I focused on species in their state that they go for, that they have the greatest passion for, and they're going to pay the closest attention to. I can talk about similarities in another state, but unless I address their state, they kind of lose interest in a hurry. So I've got to get that down to where their particular passion is, and that's what I do. And when I look at, I'll look at big game species like deer and elk and bighorn sheep and mountain goats and moose and antelope. I'll look at fish species like trout and bass or anadromous species like steelhead or salmon. I even look at crabs in the ocean, you know, offshore that go into the estuaries on inflowing streams. I look at things that they go after in their stream and say, this is what's happening to them. And when I try to tell them, when I do it, I say, look, we can debate climate change in a public square. That's what we as humans kind of do. But, you know, fish and wildlife can't do that. They don't have that prerogative. They have, I won't call them choices. There are three things they can do. They can adapt, migrate, or die, so to speak, in the environment.
Right.
If conditions aren't suitable for them, they've got to go somewhere else. If they can't find somewhere else, their future is no longer viable. So, you know, we are sort of the spokesman for them. And hunters and anglers take that seriously. They say, you know, those are species that can't speak for themselves. And they have, and even in their federal funding for fish and wildlife conservation, they said, we're stepping up because it depends on us. And that's it. And the reason I do videos is because I can put a story together to help them become better informed on how the changing climate is affecting their species, the habitat, and what their future is. And it's a story that goes from the beginning through a whole host of species, wildlife and fisheries and so on, and gets to the other end. And they can get a comprehensive, coherent story, not just bits and pieces. It's not just one question or, you know, one species at one time a year. I look at everything for the whole year and say, this is what the big picture is. And if I chop it down to, you know, to a PowerPoint presentation, you can interrupt it and lose the continuity. And people who are trying to pay attention and learn something, they need that continuity. So I put it in a video format so they can see beginning to end, and they can say, yeah, I am better informed now than I was at the start. And usually what happens at the end of the audience, people say, gosh, this really is real. Climate change isn't a hoax after all. Now, what do we do about it? And that's almost always after. What do we do now?
Right.
Can I also just add?
Yes, Dave, too.
You know, because one of the other things we've been doing at the Montana Wildlife Federation is, and as part of our outreach around climate change, is going to local rod and gun clubs like Hellgate Hunters and Anglers. We have the Helena Hunters and Anglers, the Anaconda Sportsman's Club. But going to these local groups and having a conversation with them about climate change. And I think when we embarked on this a couple of years ago, it was a little scary because we didn't know what we were getting into. When we're walking into a small conservative crowd to talk about an issue that is very politically hot and controversial. But we went into it with a very deliberate mode of we don't want to talk about the politics. You know, this isn't about the United Nations or the Paris Accord or, you know, any, or the Environmental Protection Agency. We just want to talk about fish and wildlife. We want to talk about science, and we want to talk about people's experiences and the changes they're seeing. And like Bill said, you know, many of our hunters and anglers, they're feeling this stuff more than anybody because they've been going to the same spot for decades. And when we created that space where we really said, we're not going to get into a political argument about cap and trade or carbon pricing or policy solutions, but we just want to talk about the resource and about the science, people open up and feel safe to have a really open discussion.
And they want to give you their secret hideaways. So go ahead. The other piece is
they
what? That's trust.
And they want to talk about what's important, you know? The other thing that we did that and I think Bill has done this through his career, both before he was our board president and also as one of our leading volunteers, Bill has, and all of us have always really said, you know, we're going to create an open space for discussion. So, you know, if people, you know, we may have people who say, look, I see what's happening, but I'm worried that if we stop, you know, burning coal to make energy, the guys who work in the coal mines are going to be unemployed.
Right, right.
You know, and we create a space where people can, they can raise those issues and we can find a respectful solution. And, you know, this is what else we've had to communicate when we deliver this message from our grassroots back to our elected officials is, you know, that we need to get out of this highly political black and white mode of tackling these issues and just say, look, what's the science? What can we do to take care of all the other interests that are impacted? And I mean, I think it's been really refreshing and surprising to see. I mean, I don't think it's a secret that Washington, D.C. is a pretty dysfunctional place right now. And it's hard to talk about difficult political issues without tapping into some real disagreeable arguments. And I think what we've been able to do is by kind of taking that, pushing that cloud aside and saying, we just want to have a thoughtful discussion about what people care about. We've really been able to engage people on, you know, we've been able to engage a very grassroots conservative constituency on a hugely important issue. And that's been really powerful.
And it's about, I mean, it's so clear from talking to both of you, it's about respect. It's about finding common ground. And, you know, one of my dreams is that people will listen to the show and share it. There are solutions, and they're not making the national news, except for Vice News, which is one of my favorite sources of information, because they cover topics that are exciting and hopeful and, yes, challenging, but it's so exciting for me to interview two people who are clearly dedicated to finding solutions. That's what the both of you are about. It's finding solutions, and we all win. We all win, everybody, because of what you're doing.
Right.
Well, you know, this is what happens when I go to clubs to get into them to start with. You know, they're not inclined. Many clubs are not really wanting to talk about climate change based on what the news is. But, you know, I call them up, and the reason they let me in, I said, look, I'd like to tell you about, you know, the effects of fish and wildlife, but I'm not going to ask you to call your congressman or your governor or write a letter. I'm going to ask you to think for yourself. You're intelligent. You can put the pieces together. We'll show you the pieces. This is what it goes to, step one, all the way through to the end, and you think for yourself. And what they, when you give them that respect that you're talking about and do that, they're willing to listen. I'll give you an example. In Bend, Oregon, about a month after I retired, I went out to give a presentation on climate change in Oregon, my Oregon video, to a rod and gun club in Bend, Oregon, in the VFW hall. You know, these are good old boys and girls like us,
yes,
you know, in my age group.
Yes. We're talking hardcore.
Yes, right. And they're having dinner, and I'm sitting there, and a guy about 3 feet from me looks at me and says, who are you? And I said, I'm the guy presenting to you tonight. He said, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm going to talk about the effects of climate change on fish and wildlife and implications for hunting and fishing. The look in his face told me everything I needed to know.
Literally deer in the headlights.
Well, yeah, it was. You know, he got a frown. And then he said, well, who's paying you to be here?
who's in the park? What do you mean? Who's in there? I said, nobody's paying. It's what do you mean? No one's paying.
Wait. Bill, something has happened. Did you change locations, or the phone is now, your sound quality is a little bit changed?
Is it better now?
Oh, yes. Okay.
Maybe I moved my mouth off of this a little bit.
I know. That's what it's over ahead.
Anyway, and when I told him I wasn't being paid, his next question was, well, who paid for your cost to get here? I said, nobody. It was 600 miles from my home to where I was that night. He said, you paid this yourself? I said, yes. And it changed his attitude almost completely and almost immediately. Rather than argue during the presentation, he thoughtfully listened and asked some very good pointed questions at the end. The next night I was going on the coast of Oregon to give another presentation to another club in a tribal casino. He followed me out to my truck and said, tell me more. And then before I left, he went to the club president and said, this guy is doing it on his own. They gave me a check for $100 to cover my fuel.
Wow.
He went from someone who wanted to deny the phone and said, holy cow, I think I'll listen.
Yeah.
And many of the clubs I've gone to, at the end of the night, rather than direct questions at me or argue back or give points of denial, they will turn to each other and say, I saw those red shoes of mountain pine beetle. I don't know why there's so much more than there used to be. Well, I don't know why the streams are so low. And they start sharing experiences and their observations with each other. And it's always been an indication to me when they do that, now they're getting it. Now they're not arguing. They think about, wow, what does this mean? Now I learn things that I didn't know about. And I'm finding that when you give respect to people and they think about what they've observed and they see the information you presented, they're willing to listen.
And it, to me, there's so many things for all of us to learn from this. And Dave, do you want to reflect on that? Because obviously your organization enjoys a very, very sweet spot and a lot of respect among your constituents within the state legislature. Is part of that because, I mean, look at the people involved. I know two of them right now. Do you think a critical part of finding that ground to move things forward for the common good and conserve habitat and keep access to public lands, is it your approach? And how do you spread the word? Because we all win when you do that.
Well, and it's definitely something that we really push as a core value of the Wildlife Federation, is that we participate in and respect healthy debate and disagreement. And we know that, you know, not everyone's going to agree on every issue, but when we can find common ground, let's pursue that common ground and let's respectfully disagree when we have to disagree. And I think, you know, making sure that we can do that, it's really important so that we can build those bridges. And whether it's about, you know, talking to our own constituents about a complicated issue like climate change, or whether it's about some of the other areas we work in, like the discussion we were having before about public lands, you know, our ability to talk to people who work in the timber industry, or people who, you know, who want motorized access to wilderness areas. You know, we need to be able to talk to people who have different values from us, and we need to be able to do that respectfully and find common ground. And, you know, if we can't do that, we won't make any progress.
Yeah, and it works. And I'd love both of you to comment on, you've had some really devastating wildfires in important areas, lots of evacuation. I don't know what the final number is on one of them. I read, I think, about Rice Ridge Fire and how many acres it was destroying, and, you know, ballooning to 55,000. My husband and I have been the victims of one of the biggest wildfires in the Southwest several years ago. It was 563,000 acres, and it got our very old log cabin. So I understand the impact. And of course, to me, it was like, oh yeah, Mrs. Green's cabin burned down. And climate change is, we have the bark beetle infestation, and you name it, you know, it goes on and on. So what is the situation with the wildfires? And as it relates to the importance of both of your messages, we're seeing, feeling, and experiencing the impact of climate change, and what a price tag.
Yeah. Well, and that's definitely, I mean, there's a couple of things when we talk about this really tough wildfire season that we just had. here in Montana and across the West, is there's sort of two things going on. One is the science is increasingly clear that this is being driven by climate change, that what we're seeing is what we can expect to see in the future. And it can be politically challenging because, you know, when the forests are burning, politicians want to take action. And how to tackle the climate change problem, you know, that doesn't put out the fire that's burning on the ground right now. And so I think we need to just continue to build that public support and say, look, we want to do something about this over the long term. And it's a challenge. You know, the other side of the fire equation, of course, is forest management. And, you know, that's been a really contentious issue, for decades, since definitely the 1970s and 80s all over the West and definitely here in Montana. And, you know, it's we've really, in the last 10 years or so, had a lot of real breakthroughs in Montana and I think all over the West when people who used to fight over forest management decided that they could gain more by sitting around the table and looking for common ground. And, you know, when we've kind of moved out of the old timber wars, and really when what we have today is wilderness advocates and the forest products industry and local communities are all sitting down and saying, can we find some common ground? And we have a couple of great examples around Montana. And in fact, one of them was right in the area of the Rice Ridge Fire in the Sealy Swan. There's been a group meeting there for many years, the Blackfoot Clearwater Stewardship Project, where they've really developed a plan that would protect wilderness areas and also expedite other areas for forestry and for timber harvesting to improve the health of the forest. And at the same time, in addition to wilderness forestry, they've also provided, or the plan also includes, providing more trails for public access and also recreational snowmobiling areas. And, you know, this is a group of really diverse interests that traditionally haven't been able to get along, but they've come up with a plan where everybody wins.
Wow.
And we've been really putting a lot of energy, along with a number of other conservation groups here in Montana, putting energy into really getting the Blackfoot Clearwater Stewardship Project written into law. And that's just one example. There are similar collaborative projects in other parts of Montana and all over the West. And I think, you know, that's really the way of the future, is putting aside the political fights and saying, can we sit down and look at people's underlying interests and really find common ground that improves things for everybody?
I have drawn more Venn diagram circles on napkins and on pieces of paper in the past year than I have probably in my whole life. It's like, okay, here's the Venn diagram. Let's start with what's in the middle. A very, very dear friend of mine, Alan Thompson, and I'm going to tell him that I mentioned his name on the radio. He and I are friends, and we really disagree on a lot and thought we were going to hate each other. And what it's turned into, and I mean, that's a little bit strong, but I'm a drama queen. So the thing is that what we found is so much respect. We respect family. We respect outdoor wildlife. He's a hunter. He's a fisher. He cares deeply about the planet. So we get together. We exchange books. We exchange articles. And to me, and I say to him, how can we find more of us so that we are doing things for the greater good? So, Bill, did you want to comment anything about using, the sadness of the wildfires to kind of, no pun intended, fuel your arguments about there's such compelling evidence, and it's unfortunately it's devastating. Here's what climate change is doing. It's ruining people's lives and burning down their homes. So does it help with what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I do, Joel. I show in some, particularly in New Mexico and Colorado and Montana, how climate change is affecting fire frequency and intensity, and it has been severe.
Yes.
And you find out that, for example, that there's a thing called hydraulic stress in the tree. When the temperature gets so high, like you can get in Arizona and New Mexico really high, and it's getting much higher under climate change, the trees do not have a flow of water through the tissue called xylem. It's the canal up the tree, the tube up the tree, so to speak. You get a hydraulic failure. The tree starts to dry out and die because it's not getting enough water. And then when that happens, then you get a proliferation, an explosive increase in the pine beetles, like the mountain pine beetle up here in the north, or what they call the pinyon ipse beetle down in Arizona, New Mexico. Now that the tree is weakened and starting to die, you have a prime environment for the pine beetles to go in, a tree that's already in trouble, and make it worse. And then you effectively kill the tree more quickly. So now you have a tree that's dying more quickly, and now you have, they burn quite readily. But it starts with hydraulic failure, and the hydraulic failure is a result of intense heat, lower stream flow, and lower snowpack. You know, in the West, we're snowpack states for the most part. Most of the Intermountain West relies on snowpack to maintain enough water through the remainder of the year, whether it's for fish or for plants or for other species. And when the snowpack, like in where I live in Montana, we've had about a 19% decline over the last 50 years. 19% amounts to quite a bit of water flow. You see it, we have shorter winters, less snowpack, less runoff, drier vegetation, and more fires. We have hydraulic failure in trees, and then we have fires as a consequence. They burn more readily, and they're larger, and they're more intense, they're more threatening. And remember, our forest out here, lodgepole pine forest, already fire-adapted forest. Lodgepole pine cones are what they call serotonous, which means they open up when they burn. When there's a fire, the cones open up, and the seeds pop out, and they restore the forest. But when the fire becomes so intense, sometimes you can burn all the biological material, so there's not even that left in the end. So you're taking a forest that's already fire-prone, and it's making it worse. And it's a direct consequence, in many cases, of climate change. And a lot of folks say we need to log it more, but there are many areas that are heavily logged. Let's take British Columbia, which has very intensive logging and very few regulations moderating that. And they are heavily affected by climate change, or forests are showing hydraulic failure and mountain pine beetles, more so than any place I know. And they've had tremendous fires this year, even where they've been logged heavily. The fires spread quickly in the undergrowth that have come up after they've logged the trees. And so it's one of the prime examples, but it's not the only one, but it's one that people can see when trees are dying, and they're dying more quickly, and the fires are larger. Yes. That's a consequence of a changing climate.
That's a big one. It's a big one. And Dave, we have not a lot of time left, so I have a couple more questions about, you know, I read a quote from one of the newsletters that was on the website for the Montana Wildlife Federation, and I want to read the quote. And it said, "The hard work of the MWF volunteers and staff, combined with our constructive relationships with lawmakers and our strong coalitions with other conservation groups, resulted in several major victories for wildlife and outdoors." And this was the summer newsletter. "We also held the line against efforts to undermine our natural heritage." So this is kind of like a personal question for you, because you have a really big role. It's an amazing organization. You've experienced a lot of victories. Do you find any time where you're personally challenged between your own beliefs and what you'd like to see happen and the art of the deal with compromise? Does that question make sense? Like, are there times when you say, you know what, we don't want to win the war and lose the peace, so I have to step into leadership here, and this is a compromise we're going to have to look at? Can you think of any questions? You know, does that question make sense to you? You know what I'm getting at?
No, it does. It definitely does. And I guess I'll react by saying that I'm a real big believer in the sort of joint gains view of compromise. That I feel like if you're splitting the difference and both sides are unhappy, that zero sum view of compromise is lose-lose. And I think when you engage in really authentic collaboration, and when you sit down and you explore somebody else's interests, you explore your own interests, and you find a unique breakthrough compromise solution that makes everybody better off, that's what compromise is really about. And it's not always easy, but it takes some creativity, it takes a willingness to trust other people, and it takes a willingness to really understand other people's interests. The other thing that's really important is you need to have a really strong value of
perspective taking and it's being able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and say, I may not have the same values as them. I may not agree with them. I may not see the world the same way, but I'm going to look at things from their perspective, see what things look like, and see if there's some room to satisfy everybody. And I mean, I think that, you know, I think it really is possible. I mean, and I think this is where we really get forward progress on controversial issues when we break out of the old, you know, positional, I'm for it, you're against it view of the world.
What a great answer. I just have to take a deep breath. And I wrote down, I take the joint gains view of compromise, and you can be sure I'm going to be using that and quoting you or not. Maybe I'll take full credit for it, about looking when you look at compromise. And I've never heard it articulated quite that way. So thank you for that great answer. That's a great tweet.
Sure.
Allow me to just say it's a great tweet. And Bill, my question for you is, are you ever in a position where your passion for raising awareness about climate change and the science that you know and what you're trying to accomplish conflicts with your role as president of the board of the Federation? Does it ever happen when you think, I've got to really step down from this issue because I don't want to compromise the Federation? Do you ever find yourself in a situation where you have to think about that?
Well, usually when that comes up, it's because you can't focus all your energy on one issue.
Right.
You know, there's many things that the Montana Wildlife Federation deals with, whether it's game farming or climate change or maintaining access and use of public lands. And our volunteers are often working full time, and they're volunteers. They only have so much time. And when they come to a meeting, we have several topics. We can't take all of it just on climate change. And that's often where I find it, is we got to talk about other things as well. And we have to talk with equal passion and vigor. They say these other things are important to us right now. The future is important and the now is important. And we have several things and we have to deal with all of them, not just one of them. And that's the most pragmatic thing that usually happens. We have to spend our energy on things that are important to other people, not just in what I came for one day. I may have a concern about climate change today, but I also have other responsibilities, as does Dave. When we hold our board meetings, we have long agendas covering several topics, and all of those topics are important to other people. It's part of the collaboration and compromise. You're addressing things that are important to other people, and you're giving it your time and attention just as the one that's really important to you right now. But we do all of them, and we ask them to return the compliment, so to speak.
Well, when I am feeling down and really down and out, I'm going to listen to this show again to remind me that there are people out there doing the good work and finding compromise. And then another fantasy of mine that I'm going to put out there is when I have the capacity to just do things remotely. You know, my friend Heather White at the Yellowstone Park Foundation and a lot of you amazing people are going to be on my road trip so that I can come and see some of these amazing places and experience it. The last thing I want to say to people is I encourage you to go to the website and give yourself a treat. Go to montanawildlife.org. I encourage you to watch the clip about Bill on Vice News that can be provided to you by emailing Gina or Kelly at Mrs. Green's World. I want you to be able to see that. And Bill, I think I'm going to give the last moment to you after I promo the next shows. Ryan Anderson will be on our local show, Down to Earth. They're doing an amazing thing with Sunnyside School District. It's a school challenge to lower energy efficiency. And then our show on December 12th is Kathleen Hayhoe. And we titled that show Meet the Climate Scientist. She's one of the top climate scientists in the world. She does not ever appear with climate deniers. And she's working very closely with faith-based organizations. I can't wait to interview her. So, Bill, you have about 1 minute to say, why are you giving up your retirement and spending your own money, not giving it up, using your retirement to do something so profound and important for all citizens of the planet?
You know, I find myself asking that same question to myself. And Well, my wife supports me completely on this, and she knows my passion. And,
right.
And we experience it. We say, this is real. It's not fake. It's not caused by China, so to speak. It's not, you know, this is real. And to me, there was something the other day when I was in a climate presentation and someone was talking about the fourth happiness.
You know, you have 30 seconds, so you have to hurry.
And the fourth, the fourth happiness is you get the greatest joy and satisfaction when you're working on something bigger than yourself.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is bigger than myself.
Oh, my gosh. You two are awesome. And we will be spreading the good green word, and we appreciate it. I don't know if you noticed, we didn't even take the second break. I did the ixnay on the second break because I wanted to hear everything you had to say. Thanks for the work you're doing. Thanks for showing up in the Mrs. Green's World Path. And everybody, I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. Make it a great green day. Thanks, everybody.